Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. How do poverty and low levels of education affect the health of Americans, African Americans, I should say, in St. Louis? Later, we'll focus on the mental health component. But first, we're going to discuss the parental rights of fathers and their rights when marriage is dissolved. There is an impression that the advantage in such situations goes to women. Does it? Should it? With me in studio to talk about it, Heather Biagi, litigation manager with the Cordell & Cordell law firm. From the Father Support Center of St. Louis, Halbert Sullivan is president and CEO. Liesl King-Williams is an attorney and director of legal services. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Don.
I'm going to ask each of you the same question. I'll start with you, Heather, and work across the table. What do you see the main issues to be in the field of fathers' rights?
Well, there's a lot of issues dealing with fathers. However, primarily, I would say it's usually custody and visitation. Obviously, it goes hand in hand anytime someone's getting a divorce or filing a paternity case. Obviously, the reason for filing a paternity case would be for custody and visitation. And you find that depending upon what type of case and the history with the father and the child, that there are difficulties in the court system in dealing with, you know, obtaining custody and visitation rights, depending upon what your client is looking for.
Liesl, how about you?
Like she said, there are a myriad of issues. In our particular population, we're primarily dealing with parents who are not married. They are paternity cases. And you will find there's a tendency in the court, specifically when you're dealing with newborns, young children, for whatever reason, to want to give them to mom when the social evidence clearly indicates that that's the time for bonding with both parents. The state of Missouri, through a statute, has even said that it's the policy of the state that the child have a meaningful relationship with both parents, which I interpreted as starting off as 50-50 on even scales. And the particular facts and circumstances can certainly tip that scale in favor of one parent or the other. But I have found in the courts that they don't necessarily approach it that way. Also, in our particular population of parents who are not married and dealing with people who are on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, the child support system definitely has detrimental effects with respect to that population. The way child support is calculated in the state of Missouri, you will find on the scale that they use to calculate the presumed or assumed child support amount, non-custodial parents who are on the lower end of the income scale are paying a higher percentage of their income towards child support. For example, I believe the chart now goes up to gross income of $30,000 a month. And let's just assume mom is not working. That all belongs to the father. So that's $360,000 a year. And for six children, the presumed child support amount is only like $4,386. That's ridiculous. Whereas someone who has zero income, they have to pay at least $50. So those are the two things that I find are the repetitive problems in the courts. Now, of course, it's going to change from judge to judge. And I do have to say that it is getting better, that they're not so pro-mother. I've been successful in getting a lot of 50-50 custody plans. But when you're dealing with newborns and small children, it typically is an uphill battle.
Right. Albert, how about you?
Well, first of all, thank you for this opportunity. The Father Support Center is not necessarily a father's rights organization. We are a children's rights organization. My primary reason for creating the agency was so that we can impact outcomes for children, and one of the greatest impacts is the financial support. However, when you ask the question about the rights of the fathers, I'll have to climb up on Liesl's back a little bit. But I'll take it a little bit deeper. For your never married, non-custodial parent, he has no rights. He has no rights. Liesl alluded to it when she said normally the courts lean more towards the mom in most situations. And that's what occurs when we look at so-called natural rights. For this never married, non-custodial, oftentimes impoverished father, in order to get some rights, he has to go into a court of law. And we all know how expensive that can be.
Are we only talking about custody in this context? I mean, it seems to me that there are other issues that that would arise, particularly in cases where there is no marriage. That would be if the woman chooses to put the child up for adoption, for instance, or if she would like to have an abortion.
Well, I'm going to really leave that up to these two attorneys. But while I got the mic, I do want to say, no, we're not just talking about custody. We're talking about the entire custodial law, per se, or family law, starting off with the paternity establishment first and foremost. We have a lot of situations at Father Support Center where the guy comes in and he claims he's not the father of the child. And so there are some issues around those rights and how to get those rights established, particularly when we talk about the very low-income populations where we have people whose incomes is 200% below the poverty guidelines, and they are directed to go into a court of law to have these things established. That is a problem for that man. But I like to leave that to the attorneys. They know the law.
All right. Well,
there's something called the putative father registry here in the state of Missouri. And it's my understanding, basically, every time you have, I guess, unprotected sex with a female, you can register and say, I, John Doe, slept with Mary Smith on January the 1st of 2013. So she, within a relevant time period, I don't know, 8 to 10 months or something like that, gives birth to a child in the state of Missouri. They would then notify him, you may be a dad. So that, in essence, could act to prohibit an adoption of a child that he doesn't even know, you know, it exists, or to exercise his rights. Whether or not that is a practical way to deal with that situation, I think not. I don't even think I've ever had a single client, and I've had literally over 1,000 since I've been with FSC, ever hear of the existence of this registry. So.
I cannot imagine someone signing that list. apparently they don't. No one does.
Yeah. I will say that, you know, based on what she had to say, that is correct. Anytime one has sex with someone, they could sign this putative father registry. But I have had clients who have. Now, keep in mind, we're talking about the difference between a paternity case versus a divorce case. Obviously, the legal standard is if there's a child born during the marriage, the husband is the presumed father unless proven otherwise. Obviously, in a paternity matter or a potential paternity matter, I have had a few clients who have recognized the fact they've been in a committed relationship and do want to establish their rights with regard to an unborn child, and have actually signed the putative father's registry in order to maintain that relationship or to prevent an adoption or something along those lines, so that once the child is in fact born, then they can go ahead and move forward with filing a custody case. But that's the interesting thing. If you have an unborn child, you don't have really any standing or the ability to file a court case at that point in time. And the best that Missouri offers is that putative father registry.
What we have more of a problem with is situations where the child is here, mom has custody, and she has been accused of child abuse and neglect, which would take place in the juvenile court, and they want to put the child in foster care. I have found that if dad is not on the birth certificate, and simply because there is a judgment of paternity does not necessarily mean you get on the birth certificate. Someone has to literally take the judgment to the Bureau of Vital Statistics, and I think it's a $20 fee, which could be cost prohibitive to several people, to actually enforce the order and get on the birth certificate. So number one, they don't necessarily have a way to determine who the dad is unless the mother is forthcoming, and he'll end up with a child being taken into foster care and trying, or getting adopted ultimately, and trying to get the child back.
Go ahead, Heather.
I was just going to say, and keep in mind, it's very interesting in Missouri and in other states that the state can assess that you're the father for purposes of paying child support only, versus them assessing that doesn't establish that court-ordered where you can get your name on the birth certificate and that you are the father. So keep in mind, in Missouri, we have a lot of clients who come to us who are the father for purposes of child support only because the mother has filed a state child support action. but they don't have any. Just because you pay child support doesn't mean you have custody or visitation rights. And the only way for a father to get those things is to file a court case in the circuit court system.
Do you feel that the system is weighted against the father?
Yes, in some instances, and I think it depends on what jurisdiction you're in and what court system. Keep in mind that, you know, I find that the judges in the city and the county are very progressive. But as you get out into the counties, you know, there are certain lawyers know their judges, and you know what judges are very pro, either starting at that 50-50 visitation scale and scaling back or scaling forward based on different circumstances. And you know what courts and jurisdictions and venues that you are going to have an uphill battle. You're going to get essentially something we called Siegenthaler, which is that one night a week, every other weekend.
Is 50-50 the exception or the rule?
I think it depends on what judge you're in front of. I have some judges who tell me, I'm a 50-50 judge. I start at 50-50 and I scale back one way or another. I have others, probably a majority, it's the exception.
I think it depends upon your economic status. One of your topics that you'll be approaching today has to do with poverty. And I think that plays a large factor into what happens in these court cases is the economic status, whether or not you have the resources necessary for a court battle that would lead to 50-50. When you look at the populations that we serve where the incomes are below 200% below the federal poverty guideline, that's almost impossible for this guy to engage in such a battle that would lead to 50-50. The services that we provide at Foster Support Center, we have afforded some guys 50-50, Lisa?
Oh, yes. I've been quite successful in 50-50, but it is very true that the economics of the non-custodial parent or the father plays a significant role. In cases where there are issues with respect to either mom or the dad being a good parent, which you would allege in the pleading, the court's going to appoint a guardian ad litem. And for the most part, whatever the GAL recommends is what a judge is going to comply with.
GAL is?
A guardian ad litem is another attorney mm-hmm. who actually represents the child or children. And their purpose in the case is to act as an independent third party to do a home visit. The children are in school to talk to the teachers, whatever, to determine what's the best interest of the child with respect to a parenting plan. There are some GALs who are just not with 50-50, you know, period. There are others that start with 50-50, and the same applies with respect to the judges. But a lot of the GAL's perspective on what makes a good parent is directly related to your economic situation. I have had GALs who don't even want to do a home visit in North City because they just don't feel comfortable going there. On the other hand, I've had GALs who have said, I don't have a problem if the baby is in the dresser drawer on the floor. You know, you don't have to have a crib to be a good parent. So, it kind of goes across a bell-shaped curve, but economics do play a role.
I want to pick up on why this is important in just a moment. We have to take a break. We'll do that now. We are talking about the parental rights of men. And with me in studio is Heather Biagi, litigation manager with Cordell & Cordell from the Father Support Center here in St. Louis. Halbert Sullivan is the president and CEO. And you just heard from Liesl King-Williams, an attorney and director of legal services at the Father Support Center. Welcome back. Continue the conversation. If you'd like to come in on it, you're welcome to do so. What are your thoughts about the parental rights of men? We'd love to hear from you at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. And we'll take a tweet at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. Now back to our conversation about the parental rights of men. With me in studio is Liesl King-Williams, an attorney and director of legal services for the Father Support Center of St. Louis. Albert Sullivan is president and CEO of that organization. Also with us is Heather Biagi, litigation manager with Cordell and Cordell. Albert, I'd like to turn to you to reflect on something that Liesl said a couple of moments ago about the social evidence that is available now with regard to children who grow up without fathers or limited exposure to a father. What are those social consequences?
Well, they run the gamut. 72% of all children that drop out of high school come from fatherless homes. 75% of all youth that commit crime are sitting in prisons, fatherless homes. We're talking about the youth. 73% of all kids that commit suicide, fatherless homes. It runs the gamut. But there is one big thing that keeps it going. 82% of all teenage girls who get pregnant come from fatherless homes. And that's a stat that just keeps that cycle of social ills and poverty going. It is most important that we have responsible father involvement with our children and our youth to sort of break those social ills, break those problems.
Lisa, it would seem to me that numbers like this would be convincing to judges to go the 50-50 route.
It's convincing to some of the judges. Some of it it is not, and sometimes they don't have a choice. For example, a lot of fathers don't realize that mothers can open up a child support case without even knowing they're doing that. For example, particularly in the impoverished community, if she goes in and receives Medicaid benefits, it's automatically open. If she receives TANF, which is Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, which is the cash benefit, which people in my generation called AFDC, it automatically opens and it creates what is called a state debt. So whatever that child support order ends up being when she starts receiving the TANF benefits, instead of the money going to the mother, it actually goes to the state of Missouri because she assigns her rights to receive it, and it creates the state debt. Now, under the federal guidelines, the non-custodial parent is 100% responsible for that state debt. And a lot of times, the mothers, they don't even realize what they're doing when they're applying for TANF, that they are, in fact, opening up a child support case against the father. And it could very well be a situation where they're not married, but he's involved in the kid's life. He's participating financially to the extent that he is able to do that. And she doesn't know that this is the consequence of that.
So. Heather, I would think that the clients that you're dealing with are a different client.
They are somewhat. I mean, again, we run the gamut on representation of people from different socioeconomic backgrounds. And again, keep in mind, too, we have, I think, where Liesl deals with more of the clientele that have paternity cases, you know, there is a little bit of a different delineation between those getting divorced and kind of the children being, the custody and visitation being determined based on divorced families, families that have usually live together up and until the divorce or while the divorce is pending, and then those that are filing only a paternity case. Now, we do get a lot of clientele that have had exactly what Liesl has described, is the state has notified them that mom has either came to the state asking for benefits or came to the state asking for a child support determination, and they're not equipped to handle the state system either for determining child support. And again, that's where I had commented earlier, where you can be deemed by the state to be dad for purposes of paying child support, but not dad for purposes of having custody and visitation. And the state paperwork does read, you know, given the fact that you're determined to be father, this doesn't give you any custody or visitation rights. And then that's when a lot of our clients have to say, okay, now's the time, whether they'd been planning on doing it beforehand or now is the appropriate time, or they realize that now there's some animosity and we need to move forward, they file the case. Now, keep in mind, with custody and visitation in the court system, it's a best interest standard. And again, based on that socioeconomic issue in a case you are dealing with, I mean, custody cases, especially contested custody cases, I tell all of my clients, they're the most expensive cases because what's in the best interest of the child? It's not a mathematical equation. It's not if you fit into X and Y, then you get Z visitation. It's something that's based on the judge's comments, potentially. If you do have a GAL involved, the GAL's investigation and determination, it has to do based on what the parents were exercising prior to the case, the level of involvement, again, depending upon if you're dealing with a couple that is divorcing or a couple that is dealing with a paternity case.
I was going to say, here again, we come to the economics of the situation, particularly when the low-income dad, who is there primarily just for paternity, he's not involved in a divorce proceeding, but he will also come to the same reality once this child support situation is put in place that now I need visitation. I need to be involved or have my child know me. And he's faced with a huge court battle. He can't hardly afford the child support payment, much less now an attorney. And working with Lisa over the last 4 years, some of these court cases can go on for a year, year and a half, with hours just piling up.
Sure. Dads just don't understand how they can be assessed child support and have to be financially responsible, and then the children can be physically withheld from them.
We have a number of calls, not surprisingly. I want to get to them. Sarah is joining us. She wants to talk about this GAL that you defined a couple of moments ago. What is that again?
It stands for Guardian Ad Litem.
All right. Sarah, go ahead with your question or comment, please.
Sure. In a situation where, you know, there's a the custody is being contested, and there is a guardian ad litem involved, but the guardian ad litem just doesn't do their job. What recourse does one have if the guardian ad litem does not follow through on the responsibilities of, you know, going and doing home visits and so forth, and yet end up playing a very important role in terms of deciding who, in fact, will have custody? And I'll take my answer off the
air. Go ahead, Liesl.
Prior to, I'd say about 2 years ago, there really weren't any standards that had been put pen to paper with respect to what a GAL was supposed to do. Now there actually is a specific list of things that they have to do, and they have to provide a written report to the court that they did these things, what they did, what the results are. So they would not be able to get away with not doing a home visit, because that actually is a requirement of the court. Even given that, I have still found in my experience with GALs that depending upon who your GAL is and their particular or personal perspective with respect to custody and visitation, it can go one way or the other way. Sometimes, and it again depends upon your judge, they will allow the lawyers on the case to select, come to an agreement on who the GAL is going to be. And others, there's just a list, and they'll just pick the next person on the list. You don't have any input in that.
And you know whereof you speak, because you were a judge in the city of St. Louis, as I understand it, for a period of time.
For a municipal court in the city, yes, for 10 years, yes.
Yeah, but you did not deal in that capacity with these cases?
No, not at all,
like
just
this.
Local okay. City ordinances.
Let's go ahead, Heather.
I was just going to say, I think in any case, selection of a GAL in the sense that you can select one, and again, it's based on attorneys agreeing or the judge appointing, having a GAL that you know to go out there and do their job and to mandate doing the guidelines that are set forth by the court is extremely important. Now, there is the ability to disqualify a GAL. I mean, I can tell you in my history, I've never had to do that. I have had in cases where my client has disagreed with the assessment of the GAL, attempted at trial to kind of point out what was and wasn't done or the disagreements in the findings at trial. It's difficult, though. It's very difficult.
I can see why that would be the case. Back to the phones. Let's bring in Matt, who's calling from St. Louis County. Go ahead, Matt.
Yes. I was divorced back in 94, and like your panelist said, it was the old mom, you know, got everything. And then, you know, I only got one day during the week and every other weekend, every other holiday. And I was in the lower middle class of my range of financials. And so mom got everything. I couldn't fight for anything more, just like the gentlemen were saying, because of finances. And then when I got remarried and my wife fell in love with my daughter fell in love with my wife, we went back for, you know, 50-50. And it turned out that I had to get a guardian ad litem. At that point in time, the judge was still, I guess, going down the list. And I evidently, we had an awesome one because she did everything that you were talking about, talking to teachers. And this was in 2004, talking to parents, lawyers, everybody involved. And we got 50-50 custody at that point. And it turned out that it upset the mom so much, she said, the heck with it. Even though we were given 50-50 and child support was, I got child support because I had more custody of her. Of residential custody at that point for school purposes, I had less than a third of what my child support was established 10 years earlier.
All
and
right.
That's yeah, how I find it very unfair on that point. Moms right. usually don't have to pay as much.
Okay, got the idea. The two attorneys here are both nodding as you speak. I guess this is, Heather, I'll start with you, familiar territory.
Well, I can't say that I've never ran into his particular situation because I have. And with regard to the child support is calculated in Missouri based on the Form 14, which is this, as I explained it to my clients, this big mathematical equation that has rules and comments that apply to it. And you have to keep in mind that child support is based on, and I'm no mathematician by any means, but it is based on the gross incomes of the parties. So I don't know, I can't speak to that gentleman's particular situation, but if his ex-wife didn't earn as much, but the child support was flipped such that she had to pay, that can comport with the fact that he might not be getting as much child support as he had to pay to her. Now, I'm not presuming that a man earns more than a woman. We found, especially now, that some of those dynamics are changing in relationships, but it is based on that mathematical equation. So the only thing that would lead me to believe, based on what the brief information we got from him, is perhaps she just didn't earn as much as he did, and based on that calculation and plugging in all the numbers and whatnot, it's not like just because he was paying $500 in child support, if he's now the person to receive it, she has to pay the exact same amount because it's based on her income.
Based upon what the caller was saying, and you said this was in 2004 that he got the modification. In 2004, the biggest court-ordered visitation credit you could get was only 34%. It has since then been increased to 50%. So if both of the parents are making relatively the same amount of money and you literally do have 50% of the time, that you will get a 50% visitation credit. And I'd like to reemphasize that that credit is given on the Form 14 only for court-ordered visitation. Even if mom and dad have their own agreement and he's seeing the kid, he does not get credit for that.
It is a complicated process, no question about that. Time is beginning to get away. I think I have time for another call, perhaps two. Let's bring in Michael calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Michael.
Thanks. I have two quick comments. I guess on the GAL first, it really, if you get a bad GAL, you really can't get rid of them. The attorneys are all GALs. The GALs are attorneys. You talk to a judge and they'll say, oh, just get rid of the GAL. They're not doing their job, but then no attorney will want to step on the other attorney's toes. The other comment, people will say what's in the best interest of the kids. I disagree. How can you say that and say it's socioeconomic? If you can't afford to fight for your kids, then it's really not about the kids. It's about the money, and it's about how much you can spend to buy justice. And there again, it's not even about justice. And typically attorneys don't want you to resolve anything because they're fanning the fire so they can collect ultimate, you know, as much fee as they can get.
Thank you.
That's my experience.
Oh, okay. Well, we thank you for the call. Albert, I know when he says it's all about the money, you're nodding because that's what you think it's all about all the time.
Well, economics play a huge role when we deal with the justice system, and we all know that. And for many of these dads, they are tasked with paying the child support even before the case is settled. So it becomes very difficult paying the child support. And these court cases with these attorneys, they can be quite lengthy. So you have to pay the hourly fee for the attorney, pay the child support, and then figure out a way to live as well. Not to say that the mom is not due to child support, not to take anything away from that situation. But economics, she does not have to pay, unless we're talking about a divorce situation.
Yeah. Let's, in the time we have left, I'll ask Heather and I'll ask you, Lisa, what recourse do men have if they find themselves, and again, we're focusing today on parental rights of men. What recourse do men have if they feel that they're really caught in a trap that they can't get out of?
I mean, you know, I would say if, as far as a court case goes, you know, certainly putting forth your best efforts, being as involved as possible, you know, minding your P's and Q's, having things to prove that you're involved in the child such that you can be. Being really prepared for a court case, if that's the way that you have to go, I think is extremely important. I tell clients all the time, you know, give me all your best evidence and give me the worst. What's mom going to say about you to keep you to keep custody away? What's mom going to say that's great about you, or what's great about you? You know, being as involved as you possibly can if you're dealing with a divorce situation, if you're dealing with a paternity case, you know, striking early. I mean, when you're dealing with a newborn situation, making it well known right away. I mean, it's a very difficult, there's no one answer or one solution. And I have ran into cases that seem extremely similar and they're all different. And that's the problem. If there was a formula that worked for all of these cases, we'd probably all be out of business. I mean, it would be follow X, follow Y, and then you get Z. And that's just not the way that it goes, because there's so many moving parts. There's so many players, potentially, different facts and whatnot.
Sure. Lisa, how about you?
Early intervention is key. And when I say early intervention, I'm backing up all the way to the decision to engage in an act where you might have a child and you're not married, having a child out of wedlock. You need to think about that, first of all, because once you do that, you've then placed yourself in a situation where you have other people, judges, GALs, lawyers, yeah, making the determination about what is in the best interests of your child. Number two, you know, for fathers who feel that they're in these situations, they should give the Father Support Center a call. Our phone number is area code 314-333-4170.
We'll put that on our website, sdlpublicradio.org, by the way.
Okay. My third comment is legislative efforts. The law is the law, regardless of what the brilliant attorney you have, myself, Ms. Biagi, or whomever, the law is the law. And in order to impact it and to change it, you have to go through the legislature.
All right. Well, we're going to have to end it right there. I want to thank you all so much for being with us. It's a complicated subject, needless to say, but perhaps we've given a lot of people out there, hopefully not a lot of people, but people who are involved, some food for thought. I want to thank you so much for being with us. You just heard from Liesl King-Williams, who was with the Father Support Center. Albert Sullivan is the CEO and president and founder of that organization. Heather Biagi is with us from Cordell and Cordell. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Don.
When we come back, the latest installment in the local study on how poverty and low education levels affect health in the African-American community. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.